All right, I'm Ryan Metlin, and I'm 45 years old in, what's the date today?
Today is June 23rd.
All right, 4 days. In 4 days, I'll be 45.
So, question number one is, what kind of student were you in high school? Were you a jock? Were you a nerd? Were you a straight-A student? Were you a...
I was a student who did everything. I except study. I did choir and piano, and I did trumpet. I was in band, marching band. I was a cheerleader. I was on a soccer team. I did swimming for one little bit. I was a Boy Scout. We started the rollerblading club because rollerblades were new.
Oh, wow.
At the time. And I was in drama.
So you had
I did everything except study.
You had a really full plate.
Yeah, and then I did, and then I also, like, the last 2 years prepared my portfolio because I wanted to go to art school. So I did private art lessons.
Wow. Too. Did you get good grades in high school, or?
No, I got, well, I think B's. I think, Grandma Merrill asked me, my mom asked me, how come you don't get A's? And I said, well, the difference between A's and B's is effort.
Well, at least you're honest.
That's, yeah, right. But no, I liked school and I liked learning, but I wasn't. B's were, we were, that, we could get away with B's. So.
Yeah. Your parents were okay with B's.
Yeah.
They weren't like.
Yeah. They're different than me.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
So we've been telling a lot of stories about crazy things that. That siblings did and the grandkids did.
Mm-hmm.
Is there any particular event that stands out that you got in a lot of trouble for as a kid that makes a good story?
Oh,
take your parents' car when you weren't supposed to, or drinking underage, or sneaking out kind of thing?
Yeah, we didn't really do that stuff. I mean, we were out in the woods all the time because where we lived was all the housing is on, like, well, there's 1 acre, 3 acre, and 5 acre lots. And so we were sort of early into the development. And the development was called Fox Hall. Still is. Kit and Merrill live there still. And there was a bunch of horse trails that ran throughout the forest. It's, you know, it's in the Pacific Northwest, so it's largely forest. It's forest and fields. And there was about 7 miles, I think, of horse trails that wound their way through all the lots. And so that made it really, there was all, you know, we got in trouble for all sorts of things. But often we didn't get in trouble for the things we should have, or we got away with the things
right.
that we shouldn't have. And so, like, for instance, I mean, I mentioned that it was different, sort of my growing up versus my kids. Like, we were just sort of released into the wild.
Yeah.
And told, and even though it was a suburban neighborhood, it was a fairly rural suburban neighborhood. And so we were released into the woods, and we would survive on huckleberries, and we would crash through the trails and knock down all the stinging nettles. And it was fun.
This is you and Joel?
Me and Joel.
Was there other neighborhood kids that you hung out with, or mostly just you and Joel?
There was one other neighborhood kid, and he's got that neighborhood kid sounding name. He was Josh Hartwick. So Josh Hartwick was my age, so, and then Joel was sort of the tag along, and he would tattle on us when we would get into really big trouble. But one story in particular I remember, so on the this isn't the case in California where we live now, but in Washington there's ditches along the roads to catch all the water from the lots, and then the ditches carry throughout Fox Hall. The ditches carry all the water through culverts underneath the driveways down into a big water retention pond, where then it sort of allows the water, it collects the water and then allows it slowly to go into the Sound down creek, right? But so the longest, sort of the last culvert before you get into the retention pond is probably, I would say, 50 to 100 yards, somewhere in there, underground. And so we would go...
I think I see where this is going.
We would crawl through that. When we were probably 5 years old, through that.
At five?
Yeah, I think really at five. Maybe seven at the latest.
Still.
Seven at the latest. The culverts are fairly big, not big enough that I could fit in them now, but big enough that my 7-year-old boys could. And
well, so as a parent of 7-year-old boys, is that not absolutely horrifying. Terrifying?
Yeah, right. Yeah, because right. I mean, if there is a
anything could happen.
Anything. So, but we would, so we go, because there's a fence around the pond, but we would, the way we would get in is we would go through the, and we only did that a few times, but one of the times we got all the way through, it was dark, we had flashlights, it was wet, there were frogs, and it was probably during summer, because that's the only time, I mean, but maybe it was during the weekend, I don't know. Anyway, we got through to the other side, and it was just marshy and wet and muddy, and Joel got stuck in the mud, and I was terrified because I thought I was going to have to go home without my brother. We were wearing big rubber boots, like the old school rubber boots, and the only way we couldn't get him out with his shoes on, so we got him out, but we were covered in mud, and we came home. We got in really big trouble.
So you just leave the boots there? We
pulled him out of the boots. He came home. We were completely muddy. We got in trouble for losing the boots, and we got in trouble for being muddy.
They
had no idea, I don't think, that we had been where we'd been or done what we'd
done. So you just told them, oh, we got dirty.
Yeah, we were stuck.
We lost the boots. And they
they had no idea why. It's like, no, this was life or death. We just barely
That's a perfect story. Any entertaining stories of your kids getting in trouble or doing silly things along those lines? We've been telling kids stories all week about that sort of thing.
Yeah. So, like I said, I think their life growing up is more regimented, and not that we're helicopter parents, but it's just, I think things are different now.
It's a totally different culture. That was the impression I got from the siblings too, with they're like, yeah, we used to go out in the neighborhood and come back before dinner. And like, yeah, as a parent now, like that's terrifying.
You would hear Ryan.
Yeah.
And you would just barely hear because you were far, half a mile away in a field somewhere, it might be in the neighbor's lawn playing football or whatever you were doing. But and also where we grew up, in California, it gets dark sooner during summer than it does up in Washington. And so it'd be 10 o'clock at night and be light and just starting to darken. And I remember going to sleep kind of bummed that it was still light outside.
Yeah.
So we don't have that in California.
So do you wish that for your kids? Wish they had that kind of... Or are you all completely on the other side of it now where you're like, as a parent, like, no, I want to know everything.
If the world was like it was, I'd be happy for them to have that freedom. But I think the world is different.
Just a different place.
Yeah, it's maybe a different pace.
For sure.
Now. And so they do get in trouble. I'm trying to think if there's anything in particular that comes to mind. I'm sure there's something. I have to mull it over.
It's okay.
Yeah.
What was your favorite memory of your parents growing up? Did you guys have traditions or a favorite family meal or something like that?
I don't know if we were really regimented in terms of traditions. We had we definitely had patterns. So scouting was really big.
Yeah, that's a good sure.
So for us, we were out most weekends, and so it was scouting and ski patrol. And so we were in the winters we skied, and in the spring and summer we'd be scouting, and that meant canoeing and hiking and whatever. And I think though that one of the things I remember fondly is coming home from skiing and always eating a big dinner together. I think that happened regularly, and that was always good. I remember always coming home, food after you've been exercising
absolutely.
No matter what it is like awesome. So
I know scouting is big because Kit brings it up all the time. My kid is this close to getting his eagle. So you and Joel both eagled, right?
Yeah.
How close to 18 were you? Were you right at the end? You one of those kids, or were you ahead?
No, I was 16.
Okay, so you were planning ahead.
Yeah, we weren't like a merit badge factory. Our troop wasn't a merit badge factory.
Yeah.
So it wasn't, and for me, getting the most merit badges wasn't like big on the the thing. We just got our merit badges because it was by default.
Yeah.
As you do everything in real life, you go out and camp and hike and do all those things, then you start to fulfill the requirement.
That's the best way to do it, I think, is when it's less forced and it's more organic.
And you realize how fun it is. Yeah, it's like all that stuff, like when you have to learn knots for the sake of learning knots, it's like, that's kind of not fun, creative work.
Yeah, right.
But, I mean, it's just this memorization. But when you're using those knots to tie down canoes and or use them in rappelling, like all of a sudden they have meaning and so...
What was your Eagle project?
It was actually that same retention pond.
Oh, really?
So it fed into...
Please tell me you went back and made it safe for future generations of kids.
No. So part of it... So where that water collected at Fox Hall, and actually my it was a problem for the county because it collected all the water and then it just sort of like released all the water into the creek that ran behind Fox Hall, and that took a whole bunch of sediment and eroded away a bunch of the land behind Fox Hall into the bay, and it was a problem. So at first, when I wrote it up, because we were working for the HOA, in part, because that was, I mean, it was also connected to the HOA and to private land, the commission, I don't know what they're called anymore, but they said no, it doesn't have enough public service element to it, so we had to rewrite it more with the focus on the county. Mm. And the county is the one who I felt like propelled and pushed the project forward. So basically we reduced the orifice on the outlet so that it wouldn't just pour out of there, and then it would slow down the water flow. And then we provided a series of check dams along the creek. And so there's probably 30 scouts that set up the dams along the creek. Well, for a very long time it worked. It probably, I don't know, maybe a decade ago it stopped. You know, it probably could have used a refreshing.
But sure.
It worked for a very long time. And so it's funny. It's that retention pond, though, that kind of was wrapped around.
That is a big part of your life.
Yeah, and actually it became a big part of my life because I did project management in landscape construction. I did project management and I run project managers now, but for... probably 15 years, and erosion control is part of the services that we perform as a landscape firm, and so it had this funny link where it followed me through my career,
unplanned.
Like being a PM, being a project manager, coming up, like conceptualizing the project, and then running it all the way through, like running the scout labor is very much like what I ended up doing for the first part of my career.
So it prepped you.
100% it prepped me.
That's cool.
The leadership part of scouting is, even though everything else around scouting is fun, is probably the best part is the leadership aspect. Because there aren't that many, there's a lot of activities for young people, but there's not a lot of leadership.
For sure, right. Yeah. I always tell new parents coming into the program that Boy Scouts is a camping program. Oh, no, sorry. It's a leadership program disguised as a camping program.
That's right.
The goal is to teach the kids leadership stuff. You just do it via camping and other fun stuff the way, and they don't know.
That's what it is.
Yeah. So, what was your favorite family vacation growing up? Did you go somewhere cool that was memorable?
Probably the most memorable one, and it's ironic now because we go to we live in California. We go to Disneyland all the time, but at the time, when I think I was 13 and Joel was 10, we went to Disneyland. And I remember distinctly saying when we were in North Hollywood, we were visiting Ann and Rob at my Uncle Bob. I remember after we had visited them, I remember saying, who in their right mind? I said to my dad, who in their right mind would live here? And not because of their house or anything, but because of, like, the skyline was hazy in the 80s. It was, I think, in 87 or something like that. Well, how old did I say I was? 13?
Yeah.
So it was probably 1990. And so, but I remember seeing the palm trees and the smog and, like, just saying, like, compared to where I grew up.
Yeah, absolutely.
Compared to what I knew, I said, who in their right mind would live here? And I didn't know it was going to be me. Never say that. That's the rule. So I think going to Disneyland, and it was just, I mean, Disneyland, I think when it's not, for us, it's every year. growing up in the Pacific Northwest, it certainly wasn't every year.
Is there anything like particular in Disneyland that stands out in your memory that you thought was really cool as a 13-year-old?
I remember the parades, which is funny because if you ask me like what's memorable about it now, I'd probably, you know, there's all the rides and I don't really remember the rides. It's weird what you remember. I remember meeting the characters and that was like meaningful.
Yeah.
Maybe it was scary, I don't know.
What was your first job after high school? What was your first real non like fast food kind of job?
My first job was working for Disney for Imagineering as a I interned for them while I was at CalArts one of the summers, and then after I graduated I worked for them in their show programming unit. So I worked with animatronics, did that for a year, and then there was a pretty good sized recession, but it and then I got laid off. But in that year I got to work, I got to go down to Walt Disney World and work on the Hall of Presidents. So I got to work on every time they have a new president come in, they have to sit the one who was in office down, and then they bring the new one in, they give him a speech, and then I wasn't one of their more senior animators, I was a junior animator, so they had me cleaning up all the other, I basically got to clean up all the other presidents, and then they had another guy come in and do the big speech, because each sitting president does, he's the only one standing, right? Mm-hmm. But he does the speech, so. So that was my first real job, like where I, you know, put it in quotes, real.
Yeah.
But it didn't feel any more or less real than like the roofing jobs and the moving jobs I had in college.
Okay. Let's see. So you have one brother, but Meryl obviously has five brothers and sisters, so that's a pretty big family.
Yes.
When you got married and you were deciding to have a family, was there any... Did you want to have a big family? Did you want to have a small family? Did being around your mom's family being so big, did that affect any of your decision making?
I don't think that not necessarily mom's size or you know, my dad comes from, he has two brothers, and so for, I don't think that really played into it, but family was important to me and to Heidi, and actually the first time we really talked in depth, we were joking around about what kids' names we liked, and she said, "Oh, I said, what names do you like?" I liked her right away, and she said, and she told me, "Well, I don't want to tell you because it's kind of old-fashioned. I want you to tease me." And I said, "I'll tell you what I like. I said I like an old-fashioned name. It's Henry." And then she said, "That's the name I like." Like, I don't know if she was being honest, but she was definitely being honest. And it turns out that we had Henry, you know, eventually. But when we conceived of our family, we always knew that we wanted a big family and maybe four kids. But we had kind of settled on three, and tried for three, and then got the fourth. So which I'm really happy about, because four is what I wanted, but three is what we had penciled for.
Yeah,
you know, obviously they're not cheap, so.
Are there any twins in either one of your families?
I don't think so.
Don't they usually run in families?
I think that that's like a theory, but I think it's probably more wives' tale. I think it's mostly as people are having children later. So it's not surprising that for us it was on at the tail end. People are having children later in life, and at, not to get too much into the nitty-gritty, but basically they're female reproductive system is less predictable as you age. So
okay.
So that is one of the reasons there are more twins.
Huh. Let's see. Who's your parents' favorite child? Is it you or Joel?
Oh, well, Joel gets away with more. I don't know who's the favorite. I guess I would just say Joel gets away with way more.
Okay, fair enough.
Still, always and still.
I asked literally all six of the siblings, of the grandparents, whatever you want to call them.
Yes.
And without hesitation, no delay, no thinking about it, they all just immediately said George. It was, like,
That's
surreal.
Hilarious.
Surreal. Like, nobody even had to think about it. It was weird. No.
What does that say about George?
I don't know. Yeah. There's actually, I got some good recordings of people's theories on why, and they were actually pretty interesting. So
interesting.
When this comes out, I recommend listening to it if you're into storytelling that. Where did you meet your significant other?
So Heidi and I met at church. So CalArts is located in the city where we live now, which is in Santa Clarita. That's where Heidi grew up. And Heidi grew up attending the little Lutheran church just behind CalArts, which is called Christ Lutheran. And I had an existential crisis in college. And even though I grew up Lutheran, didn't really said bye-bye to that in college. And then I had one of those come-to-Jesus moments, literally come-to-Jesus moment, and then ended up going to all sorts of different kinds of churches. But I kind of started at Christ Lutheran, and I didn't really know, but even though I'd gone through confirmation, I didn't really have a great understanding for Lutheran theology or, you know, why Lutheran wasn't like a big question in my mind. So anyway, I settled at Christ Lutheran Church, and I met her there, and then ended up marrying her there, and then my kids.
Where did you meet her there? Just going to mass?
I was freshly graduated from college, and I think she was like 17 in the youth group. I was volunteering with the youth group. I did, for the record, I did not date her while she was in the youth group, but shortly after she graduated from high school, we started dating. We married. She was young. She was 20 when we married, and we dated for a year. We were engaged for a year, and then we got married. I was 24. She's 20.
Was your family religious growing up?
I would say that God was a concept. I think they took their. I think Kit and Meryl took their vows to baptize the kids and bring them regularly to church was a thing. I wouldn't call us particularly religious. I would say that at least as far as I understand it, I think that the concept was largely the idea that God is. It's nice to know that something's bigger than you,
right?
And that's healthy. It's like it's healthy, and I think that's a good, simple way of looking at it. Yeah, I wouldn't call it religious. I would just say we went to church when we weren't doing anything else.
Okay, fair enough.
Yeah.
Let's see. So what was your college experience like? You mentioned that you went to CalArts.
Yeah.
So what was your goal? What did you want to do when you went to CalArts? What was your goal?
So like I said, when I was in high school, I spent a lot of time preparing for... Kit and I went from Olympia, and we drove all the way down the coast, and we went to several schools in my junior summer, and then found out what was required. I wanted to be an animator to find out what was required to get there. I remember when I was in high school, I went to the counseling office, and they said, what, because it's very different now than it was.
Right.
They said, what do you want to do when you get older? And I said, oh, well, I'm creative, something with art. And I remember distinctly the lady said, oh, no, there's no art jobs.
That's a weird thing for a counselor
to
say.
It's a very weird thing. And I was like, okay. And I mean, I remember distinctly she said that. And then she said, see that book over there? And I said, yeah. And it was just like, you know, one of the books with every single possible college program in it, A to Z. And I got to C. She's like, go check that out, you know, since you don't know what you want to do. And to be fair to her, like, there wasn't nearly as much marketing and other things, you know, there wasn't as much opportunity for artists as there is now. But still, it was pretty rough. And so I went and I got to see...
Is that kind of eye-opening for a high schooler? Like,
For me, it just, I don't know. Like I said, I did everything. Like, I think I'm by nature open to experience. And so... I don't really spend much time thinking about whether or not somebody I should do something or not. So
it didn't slow you down.
It didn't slow me down, no. And so I went, if anything, it piqued my curiosity. Like, well, I wonder if I could have a job in that. And so I went, I got to see, and there was the degree offered was character animation, and there was only one school that offered that. And I was like, oh, that's weird. I don't know what character animation is. And it was CalArts, California Institute of the Arts. And then I started to research the school, and I found out that it was founded by Disney, and that and that a lot of like fairly famous animators and other people had gone there, and so that was one of the schools we visited, and I loved it. The moment I walked in, I said, "Oh, this is for me." Like, I got into some state schools, and I applied to some state schools. I got into Western, and then I got into Art Center, which is another, it's another art school down in, that's in Pasadena. And I liked Cal Arts. It has five schools within the institute. And, so it has everything. It has jazz and it has a music program, a theater program, fine arts, animation, film and video and animation. And I'm forgetting one, but anyway, it has the five schools, and so it's like so eclectic. It's just such an awesome place to go.
I absolutely want to finish this conversation, yeah, but we're gonna miss that picture, and then I think that would be bad news.
No, we'd be in trouble.
All right, we're back from the picture. We were discussing Cal Arts. You wanted to study animation, character animation.
Yes.
Or you found character animation in the book, I believe, is the last thing we said.
Yeah, we found, and so I ended up going there for 4 years. I mean, it's definitely not a state school experience. There's 1,000 people. They're all kind of weird, individualistic. I mean, it's just an interest. It's not your standard college experience.
Sure.
But it was a good experience. You know, it's like, we have live jazz concerts at lunch, and like you, just everything's always going on around you. There's just creativity happening all over the place. I lived on the dorms for 2 years, and then in apartments thereafter. And then, like I said, I graduated and then went to work for Disney.
So how long were you at CalArts?
For 4 years in total.
And you got a degree. What was your degree in?
In character animation.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. I interned for Imagineering, and then came back and worked for them for a year.
Do you get any sort of leg up at Disney having gone to CalArts? Is that, you know, is there?
I would say more so then probably than now, because it was the only and best animation program, and a lot of animators and directors, not only at Disney but also Pixar, went there. So there was an advantage. There are a lot of good programs out there for animation. I would say there's still an advantage. You're in SoCal, so the studios, it's an easy stop for the studios. But I eventually realized I didn't really want to work for a studio at that time.
Was most of your work at the time, what years were you there?
From 96 to 99.
Was it still mostly paper and hand-drawn stuff?
It was all hand-drawn and computer, Pixar. John Lasseter came with Toy Story and showed it to our class before it was released. And so did Katzenberg came and showed us, because he had just started DreamWorks. He came and showed us The Prince of Egypt.
Oh, wow.
And in person. And he said, you guys are really, he told us, I've doubled your value. There used to be only one show in town.
And now there's two studios.
And now there's two.
Oh, wow.
But you know what? He may have doubled the animator's value in one sense, but animation really took off, and there are a lot of feature film studios now because of the computer, because the process isn't what it was.
So there was no computers at all at that time, not like they are today.
Like I said, they had. I mean, if you go back and watch Toy Story, it was pretty crude, like when you the story itself,
right,
but the level of rendering and the, mm-hmm, like the I mean the acting and the storytelling is all top notch, but the actual
some of the models feel stiff and stuff now.
That's
right.
So computers were kind of coming into their own, but the gist from the school was, hey, look, I mean, it was coming off the Toy Story kind of came as just as there had been that big push with Little Mermaid and then Aladdin and, Disney had like maybe four or five in a row that were just big hits, and then it started to dwindle. You know what? I'll just turn.
We're sitting in the sun, so we're adjusting because Ryan's gonna go blind here.
So it was on its way in, and the hand drawn animation was on its way. I wouldn't say out, but for sure, like even the Prince of Egypt, like he spent $180 million or something ridiculous on that film, and it barely made its money back.
Yeah.
And I distinctly remember he said, "You know what? There's this other thing we've been working on." He was super proud of Prince of Egypt. He didn't show us the whole film. He just showed us like the intro song, which is pretty stunning. And but he said, "So this is what I'm really proud of, and it's coming out soon. But we've got this other thing we're kind of working on that is I believe the company's name is PDI. I don't know what that stands for, but it was a computer animation house. And they bought that, and they were working on little bits and pieces of Shrek. So Shrek was in its infancy, and he kind of treated that as a throwaway.
Really?
In the presentation. Yeah, because I think that it was still early, and also because... Pixar knew what was coming, but not everybody did. And he put all his eggs in Prince of Egypt, and then what happened was Shrek saved his bacon.
Well, I was listening to something, they were talking about Shrek. Yeah, Shrek I think it had its 20th or 25th anniversary recently.
Yeah.
And they were talking about how risky it was at the time because it was a crude cartoon,
yes,
right?
That's right.
In the time of the Little Mermaids and the Toy Stories, and like that was a tried and true format, is that, you know, you had these family Disney movies, and then all of a sudden you've got this like belching, farting ogre.
And it poked fun at all the fairy tales.
And it made pop culture references and things that was so opposite. It was obviously a great movie, but it was very risky, and I had no idea.
And it made a ton of money.
And they made four of them?
Yeah, no, it saved DreamWorks for sure.
Yeah. So. You're at CalArts. Now you got me all excited about animation. You're right. That field has completely blown up. I mean,
yes.
Are there any real studios doing hand-drawn stuff anymore? I mean, it seems like everything is...
It's all supplemented. There's no... And it's definitely all digitized. Like, there's no...
Sure.
They're not using film. It's not what I was... trained on. We were still using video for all the pencil tests, for all the rough versions of everything, and then even when I graduated, you still didn't digitize anything. You still did it on 3/4-inch videotape, which was a really high quality videotape. And so, but I didn't make a. I learned about my. After my sophomore year, I made a short film my sophomore year, and then I decided I didn't want to do animation because it was too slow. In order to tell a story in animation, it requires an immense amount of time and resource to get out very little. Like, to make a 2-minute film takes a student, like, almost the full school year. And if you've decided halfway through, like in your, for me, I graduated with a bachelor's at 20, so which means I was in my late teens when I was making animated films, and like you change so much, like the idea of like going all in on an idea for a year when you're, you know, 19 years old.
Right.
It's like, and you're still like, I mean, you're just learning everything, right? Because
you're finding your art, you're finding yourself.
You're reading and you don't know anything. And like the idea that you're going to dedicate yourself to a story, a concept throughout the whole thing. It's actually really kind of a bad, like in retrospect, it's kind of a bad setup. Like I wish that I actually had a philosophy degree, a bachelor's in philosophy before I started in film and animation, but that's not the way it worked. So, because it would have been, you know, having your more familiarity with some of the classics and like learning about, or even I think just a general knowledge of the world, like more experience, period, much less education, would have informed filmmaking more profoundly. So anyway, I decided it wasn't, and it was the right decision. I decided I didn't want to spend my time animating. I wanted to draw and paint. And then I got published in some newspapers and then decided I wanted to go after comic strips. I wanted to do comic strips. That's what I
did. Because I think I talked to you. You did some political cartoons for a while, right?
I did do political cartoons.
But that's a tough business to break into.
Well,
it's hit and miss. And
you know, we actually got a comic strip syndicated. It took me a long time, but we broke through and we did get syndicated. But we never... But the thing is, to make a living, the problem is like the closer we got to the goal, the fewer and fewer newspapers there were.
Right.
And the less they were willing to spend on was that, comics.
I'm trying to remember, because John and Vi used to have a book on their, you know, their coffee table or whatever. Mm. Would that have been your comic strip?
I had a couple books published as well.
Okay, because I remember them. I remember going over to their house early when I was dating Angie, and they're like, oh, look what Angie's cousin did, and it was a book.
Yeah, so I did write. I wrote two books, one in 2001, which was... it got published right after I graduated, and then that was another reason that, like, so I kind of figured I don't want to work in the studio setting. The thing about studios is it's there is creativity in what they do, but there's also a lot, like being an animator in a studio, you kind of have to, it's an unstable life, unless you're at Pixar, and even with them, I think that it's kind of an unstable life. Like, you live project to project. The projects are 2 to 3, 4 years, maybe. But once you're done with that, you have to hitch on to the next one or you're out of a job. And there was that. There was the lack of creativity. And then I was also feeling cocky because I'd been published. I was in the New York Times. I was in the Wall Street Journal.
You were the New York Times?
And I thought, I did some illustration for them.
Wow.
And so then I was like, I think I could do comic strips too. So I said, I'll take a job in landscaping. It'll be something I can easily leave behind. It was just a laborer's position. And then, it wasn't quite laborers. We treated plants for fungus and insect infestation and all sorts of...
So it was just a way to pay the bills?
Yeah, it was a way to pay the bills. I was freshly married. I got laid off from Imagineering I was laid off and we got married like 2 months later. So that was a motivator to at least have a job.
I can't tell if the wind is picking up in the microphone. There's nothing we can do about it.
Yeah.
Correct me if I'm wrong, this has been 20 years since I think I've seen your book. Didn't you have Foxhall Studios?
That was Joel. So Joel had...
Oh, that was Joel.
Joel created... Joel went to film school as well. Joel went for live action, and he went to NYU for his undergrad.
Because I remember... I don't remember how that came up, but I remember... Because somebody a long time explained the whole concept of Foxhall and then how it became the studio. I just remember thinking that was kind of cool to, like, tie it all back around.
Yeah. I mean, he obviously made his first films there locally. And
Do you still draw? Do you still do art?
Yeah, so the landscape career that I thought I would quit, like, kind of like a waiter job.
Yeah, right.
Right. Two and a half years into it, I said, this is really hard work for very little money. And I kind of just put my ego down and I said, I'm not doing this anymore. I'm going to go humble myself and go work for a studio. And it was in that same week that at church, a guy who owns the company I work at now actually said, well, why don't you come work for me? And I said, that sounds terrible. I don't want to be a landscaper. And he said, well, our company's exciting and it's a fun place to work and we're growing and there's an opportunity if you want to. So I went and visited and it was very different than the place I was at. And it was landscape construction and not landscape maintenance. And so there was definitely a building aspect to it that I enjoyed. And
so it's less mundane?
Yeah, it's not about... Yeah.
Yeah.
Maintenance is mundane, and also there was a project management element to it. So I went to get a certificate in from the local state college. I went and got a certificate in landscape design. So at least I knew something. And then I started as an assistant PM, and then I worked my way to an associate, and then a PM, and then there were some stops along the way. But eventually, what I do now is I run the other PMs and business developers for the LA Ventura area. So that job that I was going to leave behind turned into a career without my knowing it. Huh. And then they just...
It's funny how that happens sometimes.
Yes, landscape development just helped me go through school to get a master's in business. And so it's been... And that was... So I haven't painted or drawn for about 18 months. And I'm ready to get back to
that. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I like to paint. I paint, like, I don't negotiate for, I like, I'm not painting so that it can, I basically don't paint to make anybody else happy. I just paint what I'm interested in or draw what I'm interested in drawing. It's not business. It's basically a, it's just a passion type thing.
So you said there was a point where you were going to humble yourself and go work for a studio. Is that a really hard thing to wrap your brain around? Like, I guess I got to go, you know, be a cog in a machine kind of
less,
thing?
Less so once I had spent 2.5 years, like, hiking slopes in 100-degree weather, you know, spraying chemicals on plant material. Yeah, like, at the end of that period, I was like, okay, I'm... The thing is I needed to find a smarter way to hold out, because it was another, like... 6 or 7 years before we reached the point of syndication. And another part of that story that's interesting is that when we did finally get syndicated, we went and visited the syndicate. And when I walked in and I saw that their offices were far less impressive than the offices that I worked
wow.
in landscape construction.
Oh, wow.
That's when I realized, we've been knocking on this door, and it may not be the...
You've been working so hard to get there, you finally get there.
There are, like, 6 people who make a very fine living. Like the Scott Adams, the Dilbert guy, he does fantastically. I'm sure he has $80 million or something ridiculous, but because of marketing and merchandising.
Oh, my gosh, yeah.
So, but it's like, you have to touch the exact right point and be just sort of in the exact... right moment. And so I just did the math and was like, I need something, I think, that can help me bridge the gap and build something other than...
Sometimes you just gotta grow up and be an adult and pay bills, and it sucks. Yeah, I mean, it sucks sometimes.
I saw a t-shirt here that said adulting.
One out of five. Yeah, would not recommend. I love that shirt.
Not recommended. I agree. It can suck.
All right. Well, I'm sure your family's missing you. I have one last question, and it should be quick. So we've been telling a lot of stories this weekend about crazy things that our siblings did. So is there a story about something crazy that you did to Joel or Joel did to you, as far as a prank, or he ratted you out to your parents, or...
He ratted Josh Hartwick and I out for attempting to start a forest fire.
Oh, geez.
Not that we were really trying to start a forest fire. We were just trying to start a fire in the forest.
They're totally different.
They're very different things. It's all about intent.
Uh-huh.
Joel definitely ratted us out for that. So
he's 3 years younger than you?
Yeah. So I think we were probably like 8 or 9, and he might have been, I guess, 6 or 7.
Yeah.
And he went back and told our... Forced.
I was just going to say,
dad.
I bet you that went over horribly with Kit, right?
I mean, the good news is we weren't very bright, so we had tried to light it in a wet stump. So it's like, that was unintentionally good.
Yeah, right.
but so we got in pretty big trouble for that. We didn't like Ryan Stoneberg, who lived not across the street, but across the street and one more down. And Ryan was a little bit older than us, and Josh and I didn't like him, so we peed down the slide, and then we invited him to go down the slide, and he was older than us, and he's like, I'm not stupid, I'm not gonna... But then we got in trouble because Joel saw us pee down the slide, and he ratted us out. I mean, but to be fair, we kind of deserved every time we got put on notice.
It's probably for the best.
It was was it was deserved he every
was,
time.
He was your conscience. Yes. You didn't even know it.
He was the Jiminy Cricket. I was Pinocchio.
All right, the last half question I have is, since we have everybody here,
yeah.
I've been asking everybody, is there a story or a person you think that I should talk to and bring up, you know, and get something on the record? Mm. You know, does your parents have something or Joel have something? And if the answer is no, that's totally fine. Yeah. Just, is there anything that jumps out like, oh, you know, you should go hear this story?
Not anything that jumps out.
Okay.
I mean, there are, it's hard to do that off the cuff.
But if you think of something else, you know, in the, you know, if you're walking back and you're like, oh, hey, make sure to ask Joel about whatever, let me know, and we can easily do it.
We'll do.
Hey, thank you very much for sitting down, sir. Yeah.